We wanted to use rapid-induced resistance as a measure for looking at the potential and the success of gypsy moth in the boreal forest, and using the parameters of fecundity, development time, and survival to measure the effectiveness of rapid-induced resistance in affecting gypsy moth larvae. And then we compared our observations to work that's been done over the last 20 years, and in fact longer, and then make projections or hypothesis about what we think is going to happen. Just push the button here to advance it. The study area was located 10 kilometers north of Arden, Ontario, which is sort of north of Kingston, Ontario, which is north of Watertown if you're in the U.S. It consisted of abandoned farmland where saplings had reestablished themselves. And the egg masses that we used for the experiment were collected from that area. We held them at 5 degrees C to time it with the emergence of gypsy moth in the field. And then once that we had that down to a ballpark figure, then we reared them on on artificial diet to second instar before they were transferred to the trees in the field. We used a randomized complete block design with a 2x3 factorial arrangement of treatments. There were two levels of defoliation, 0 and 50%, that was one factor. And we had three tree species, that was factor two. And again, the three tree species were trembling aspen, white birch, or paper birch, and red oak. So we had a total of six treatment combinations. These were replicated four times. And the tree was the experimental unit. And then we established 20 larvae in each tree, five larvae in four bags in a nylon mesh bag. The bags were moved weekly. The shoots were only used once, and the replications for the experiment were blocked by date. So it was a relatively short time here. We have 5 days over the period in which the replications took place. The mean initial instar fresh larval weight per bag was used as a covariate, and then at the end of the experiment, the pupae were morphologically sexed and weighed within 24 hours. The defoliation aspect of the experiment consisted of simulating or defoliation by tearing the leaf in half and parallel to the midrib. This was some work done by Bill Mattson, which suggested this was a more realistic approach to simulating these defenses. There were three periods of defoliation. The first two were 5% each. And that would consist of every 10th leaf was torn in half. And then the final defoliation, and each one of these defoliations was timed to try and match the defoliation that was occurring in the field. The final defoliation was 50%, and each leaf on the tree was torn in half. And then we used Tukey's test as a method for mean separation. Results for the defoliation effect. We found that defoliation significantly affected the female pupal weights, but not the male. We hypothesized the reason the males weren't affected is because their development period is probably 7 days shorter on average in the field, and so they were exposed to the biochemical changes in the leaf in the tree that took place for a shorter period of time, then it had less effect on the larvae. Defoliation had no effect on development time or survival, and in fact in each of these experiments there was no interaction, just in case I forget to mention this because I didn't put up a table. Averaged over tree species, the defoliation was reduced by female pupal weights by about 12%. Tree results, looking at the tree species effect. As expected, tree species had a substantial effect in both male and female pupal weights. And those larvae reared on aspen were significantly bigger than birch, which was significantly bigger than red oak. So we have a strange scenario developing here where we have a traditional host like red oak does not produce the most fecund pupae. And when we averaged defoliation over male and female pupae, we had a 25 and 70% larger weight of larvae on aspen as opposed to those on Irken birch. And of course, development time was sort of exactly the reverse. The longest development time took place on red oak, a traditional host for this particular species, and aspen was the quickest. So, and again, survival between the defoliation treatments and tree species did not differ. So we have this scenario developing where a traditional host like red oak does not produce the best results for this particular species for developing. The covariate was significant, which suggests that small differences when the initial second instar larval weights were taken could be used in sort of a mass production or a mass scale to produce or estimate what the sex larvae are. So larger larvae are probably females and smaller ones are males. There also was a significant replica effect, which was totally unexpected and for both the pupil mass and the development times. And this implies that establishment date for this particular insect. And remember when we talked earlier, there were only 5 days between the four replications when we set them up, plays a significant role in their success and development, and probably reflects rapid changes in phenological development of the plant. The mortality in the experiment was, except for a stink bug, which heavily parasitized, preyed on the larvae as they crawled on the bags, was insignificant in the experiment. Of course, that was the reason for subsamples in this experiment, was the fact that we were anticipating heavy larval mortality from these particular predators. So the study suggests that defoliation from gypsy moth feeding and late instars can elicit depressed growth on three tree species, each in a different family in the boreal forest. Development time in our study was not affected by defoliation. However, tree species was strongly influenced development time. But again, the question arises, why do we have aspen being a better host for development of species than the traditional host red oak? In most species, their particular host that they feed on is closely correlated with their success, but there have been mismatches noted in the literature where for one reason or another the host may not be available. It could be because of a predator, it could be because simply that the best host is unavailable at the time of the insects in the field. Well, we think we have a similar situation here too, and we hypothesize about this, but we do not think that large stands of trembling aspen and white birch in the boreal forest will support gypsy moth unless there is red oak present in the stand. And we cite a number of things in the literature about this. There's the deleterious effect of NBB and the work that was done by Schultz back in the late 80s and early 90s that showed the importance of leaf tissue pH in making larvae susceptible to NBB. There was work done by Lindros with talked about some of the alkaloids in aspen, and as I'm sure this has a negative effect on the larvae, although there's no work done that I know of that has been conducted on birch. We also have the spread of Miyamaga in the boreal forest, which certainly limits the effectiveness of larvae in this particular area. And then there's the strong impact that larvae are affected by the physical features of a host, so much so that the attraction to a host and the shape of the host and its physical features is much more important than the foliage itself and how the larvae feed, or what the larvae feed on, which is seems unusual. So we think also supporting this issue is the fact that a historical absence of gypsy moth in the boreal forest in regions where it was first introduced over 150 years ago, that would be around Maine. There's been no outbreaks to speak of in those areas that has been noted. We also use examples in Ontario where there have been no outbreaks other than sporadic outbreaks which have flashed up and then gone down and on very poor sites. And of course, if you want to read about this a little bit more, or if you've got some questions on it, this work was published this spring in Forest Ecology and Management, and you can take a look at it there. Thank you. Dan.
There's rapid use resistance from a population regulation is thought to impose a stabilizing effect. And delayed use resistance, you're right, generate the negative density-dependent effects that can generate outbreak cycles. I was wondering if you've looked at delayed use resistance.
No, we haven't looked at delayed resistance, and I probably won't because I'm going to be retiring. But there's certainly lots of things revealed from this would make interesting work to do. There's the simple work about the fact that the covariate was significant, which I think is there's no other way to sex gypsy moth larvae, and the fact that there was a significance there. And there's also, which from an ecological point of view, is the work that took on the establishment date and the fact that in each one of those experiments for development time, the establishment date, even though they're only few days apart, seem to play a very significant role in the success of the larva that took place. That's something else that would be interesting to look at. And let me add one other thing in case there's any students that still stuck around this long. That would be interesting, a natural control for gypsy moth in the boreal forest is forest tent caterpillar. I've seen this happen a number of times, and when a population of gypsy moth starts to build, or you expect it to build, forest tent comes out before that and knocks out the foliage, and that's the end of the gypsy moth. So here we have one caterpillar, perhaps simply because of its opportunity or the time of its defoliation, regulating another one that comes along about 3 weeks later. Thank you very much.
Thank you.